actions seems to negate a citizen's right to travel freely and will likely scare many away from even observing a yellow vest protest.
Un état totalitaire.
We aren't in a dictatorship, but in a totalitarian situation. The state wants everybody to keep quiet and to agree with whatever they say. This lack of democracy, why the yellow vests began in the first place. It wasn't over just gas prices. This woman's situation is one dramatic situation, but there are so, so many others like her.
On June 6th, a million-person march is expected, the 15th this year, in the ongoing fight against a 2-year hike to the retirement age by presidential decree. Police brutality is expected to be even more rampant than at the previous such march on May 1st.
Pour leur physique de venir en manifestation.
The people are afraid for their own physical safety when they come to a protest now. There are so many arrests, so much violence, and constant tear gas. This is the reason why the number of people joining us dropped, even as our national problems keep growing worse.
Besides their Saturday marches, the yellow vests are present at seemingly every public protest in France, and often around Europe as well. They regularly contend that they are willfully ignored by the government and media because the basis of their movement is economic and political redistribution. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Al-Quds International Institution has held its annual meeting of the Board of Trustees in Damascus. The meeting was attended by Palestine's ambassador to Syria, Syria-based Palestinian factions, and Syrian President Assad's political and media advisor, Buthayna Sha'ban, who is also board secretary in the institution. She called for the unity of the Arab and Islamic world in order to liberate Palestine. She set the case of Syria as an example for Palestinians that victory is undoubtedly the result of steadfastness.
Arabs have returned back to Syria. The difficult experience Syria went through for over a decade is a beautiful lesson for Palestinians that those who believe in their cause the most will triumph. President Assad's presence in the Arab League summit is not just a victory announcement for Syria, but also signals the failure of huge plots made by strongest world powers.
Speakers highlighted the heroic resistance of Palestinians in the battle codenamed Revenge of the Free in the Gaza Strip. They called for confronting Israeli attempts to Judaize Al-Aqsa Mosque, reiterating that Quds will remain the eternal capital of Palestine. The meeting comes following an Arab League summit and reconciliations between Iran and Saudi Arabia, as well as Syria and the Arab world. Such developments, according to speeches delivered, indicate that the world is heading towards a multipolar system where the West's hegemony is demolished. Speakers underlined the importance of reminding the world of the Palestinian cause and the suffering of the people of Palestine caused by the Israeli occupation. Despite the decades-long Western double standards, institutions like this believe that Palestinians' steadfastness will eventually lead them to restoring their rights. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
UN bodies issue fresh warnings about the impacts of huge fan gaps in Afghanistan. The latest such warning comes from the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in Afghanistan, which says urgent funding is needed to avert an imminent large-scale humanitarian catastrophe. Afghan experts are also worried about funds drying up and the international community turning its eyes from the war-torn nation.
Definitely, the only way out of the Afghanistan crisis is constructive engagement between the ruling Taliban and the global community. This year, hopes of heeding Afghanistan's appeal for financial aid are fading and it is very threatening. Shortfalls in funding absolutely deal another devastating blow to the Afghan nation, especially the most vulnerable citizens. We will witness more poverty, unemployment, and devastation in Afghanistan if funds continue to dry up.
The United Nations has launched a humanitarian appeal for $4.62 billion to assist nearly 24 million Afghans in 2023. However, the appeal has received very little support so far, with only 6.4% of the required funding secured. This has forced many aid organizations to scale back their activities, leaving many without help.
Aid cuts are a disaster. People like us are eyeing international assistance. We have no job and income, so relief aid can be a lifeline for us. Some are sick, they need free treatment. Some are in dire need of food and cash aid. People will die in their houses and on the streets in the absence of global aid. They have no money for themselves. First, they are relying on God's mercy, and second, on the relief aid.
Major aid cuts, Western sanctions, and the freezing of Afghan assets by the U.S. are exacerbating Afghanistan crisis. Afghans have been calling on the U.S. to release the funds and to lift the sanctions, saying they are hurting and punishing innocent people who are already suffering from poverty, famine, and hunger. Afghanistan is facing a severe funding shortfall that threatens the lives of millions of Afghan people. Aid agencies warn that the global community must act urgently to prevent a humanitarian disaster. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
South Korea and the U.S. Thursday began large-scale joint military exercises just 25 kilometers south of the fortified border with North Korea. The drills utilize some 600 weapons, including stealth fighter jets, attack helicopters, and South Korea's homegrown K-2 tanks. Participants suggest the drills are meant to be a warning.
I think it sends a message generally to the whole world about how strong the alliance is, and that conducting these readiness exercises builds our credibility as an alliance.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol has sought to respond assertively to North Korea's missile and nuclear development, in lockstep with American forces, which have 28,500 troops in South Korea. For South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol, these drills demonstrate peace through strength, the policy of promoting a strong alliance with the United States. Detractors argue that these drills will upset China, provoke North Korea, and generate a regional arms race. North Korea views such drills as a rehearsal for invasion and has previously vowed to respond militarily. And some South Koreans suggest the drills damage the prospects for peace.
When dialogue between the two Koreas progressed, dialogue between the U.S. and North Korea progressed, and large-scale military exercises were suspended, easing tensions and bringing peace. Large-scale military exercises don't enhance the security of South Korea. Rather, they undermine South Korea's security.
Four more rounds of similar large-scale joint U.S.-South Korea live-fire drills are scheduled through mid-June. Frank Smith, Pochon, South Korea.
During the Tel Aviv regime's 11-day offensive in 2021, Israeli warplanes carried out one of the most horrendous massacres in one of the most densely populated neighborhoods in Gaza. The attacks destroyed three residential buildings, killing 44 civilians, including 18 children. Rescue teams took days to pull the bodies from under the rubble. Riyad Ishkuntana and his 6-year-old daughter were among the survivors.
When the Israeli warplanes hit the building where we used to live in 2021, we were buried under the destroyed building. I spent 12 hours under the rubble before the rescue team could save me. I could hear the screams of my children calling me from under the debris. But my daughter Susie and I were the only survivors of my family. They told me that my wife and four of my children hadn't been able to make it when they found their bodies.
During the latest Israeli attack on the Gaza Strip, the family suffered again. Israeli jet fighters targeted the apartment adjacent to theirs.
I was playing with my cousins in the other room. Suddenly we heard a massive explosion. I directly rushed to my grandma. I was screaming and crying. The house was filled with smoke. I was frightened that the building might fall on us. We realized that the building next to ours was targeted. We escaped from our apartment, and so did all the other residents.
Susie hasn't been able to speak about the 2021 incident ever since it happened. She becomes speechless anytime she remembers what happened to her and her family back then. Talking to Press TV, Her father asserted that there is no safe place in Gaza for his daughter, even though they demanded international protection after the 2021 incident.
It's all lies. Palestinian civilians are never protected from Israeli attacks. We don't trust international protection regulations. She had therapeutic sessions for 2 years, but my daughter is still suffering, and that memory haunts her anytime she hears a loud sound. She deserves to live in peace and security.
Susie Shkuntana is an example of thousands of Palestinian children who suffer from trauma under the Israeli occupation.
According to reports, 90% of Gaza children suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, which indicates the extent of physical and psychological violence they experience under the Israeli occupation. Palestinian children have the right to enjoy a life of peace and safety rather than a life of horror and insecurity. Al Asif, Gaza.
The Islamic Center of England, a registered British religious charity in London, temporarily closed months after its Muslim trustees were removed by the UK's aid watchdog, the Charity Commission, over what it called the trustees' failure to comply with their legal duties and responsibilities and their failure to protect the charity's assets. The commission appointed an interim manager to the charity in early May. That interim manager is Emma Moody, a non-Muslim with the law firm Womble Bond Dickinson.
A charity is there to serve a group of people, its supporters, people who use it, and indeed has to address their needs, their aspiration from a religious or within their statutory of the charity. And that has been ignored. I mean, it's been ignored because what we are seeing now, appointing a secular, non-Muslim sort of lawyer all the way in sort of north of England to run and to sort of dictate what should happen in a mosque and in a charity, it really is outrageous.
It all started with a warning from the charity regulator over a vigil held here in 2020 for revered Iranian military commander General Qasem Soleimani, assassinated in a U.S. drone attack in Baghdad, Iraq, in the same year. The man who spoke at the event says no laws were broken.
Sardar Soleimani wasn't prescribed, or the organization he worked for wasn't prescribed, and is still not prescribed. He was sanctioned, financial sanction, for issue of Syria. Now, when somebody dies and you talk about that person, you're not supporting financially the person. He's already dead. You know, there is no issue of breaking the sanction. It's outrageous that a charity commission, an organization we're supposed to support, will actually become so political that actually sort of misinterprets the law.
In the early 2000s, the British government and the Charity Commission initiated a program calling on all UK mosques to become registered charity. And by doing so, critics say, control what those Muslim institutions could or could not say outside of what is lawful.
We reached out to the authorities here, but they declined to comment. We were told unofficially, though, that the real reason behind the temporary closure of the center, done on the advice of the interim manager, was something to do with insurance, which they hope would be resolved and the doors to the center reopened to the public soon. Saeed Purizep, London.
Lebanon has marked the 23rd anniversary of the liberation of South Lebanon from Israeli occupation. On this year's anniversary, Beirut was seen to a conference on the resistance front's fight against the world arrogance. The meeting, held by the Global Gathering in Support of the Choice of Resistance, was attended by guests from over 60 countries. The four-day congregation's theme is the resilience of the axis of resistance and its role in breaking the siege, ending sanctions, and overthrowing normalization.
This is more than necessary now. You need the people against this American-Israel aggression, because we have the same problem everywhere. You know this very good from the Middle East. I'm from Serbia. We know it as well from the Balkans. But now they start to attack the other European countries because they only use terrorism, like they kill General Soleimani.
Some participants said the liberation of southern Lebanon in 2000 and other victories for the resistance front in the last few decades are catalysts for a shift to a multipolar world.
Definitely, there's been a huge change in the world. First, because of the strength of the resistance in our region and the defeat of the American troops in Iraq, Afghanistan, in Lebanon, in Syria. This is now infecting the whole world in hope to escape American hegemony. So we see even this shift of multipolarity actually started because of the resistance in our region.
Western guests present in the conference believe there is growing awareness on the need for resistance against arrogant powers.
The awareness itself is shaped by resistance. So the actual victories in Palestine, in Syria, in Cuba, in Venezuela, these are the things that really shape people's consciousness. But we in the gathering here want to reinforce the values that people have a proper understanding of the importance of the centrality of resistance for human liberation.
An attendee said the resistance front is capable of putting an end to the Israeli regime's relentless atrocities against Palestinians.
Israel has become now a fascist regime. Israel has become a barbaric and a racist and a totalitarian regime. That is the only country in the world which has been supported by Western hegemony and also NATO. But their time, it is nearer. And the resistance and the people of the world, through the international solidarity movement, they will find ways to dismantle the Israeli apartheid regime.
The delegations will be taking a tour to villages in southern Lebanon. They will also pay an official visit to Syria to show solidarity with Damascus in the face of U.S. sanctions.
Major transformations in recent years have caused more and more people to resonate with the values of resistance. Participants here consist of not only Lebanese and Palestinians, but people from around the world who are against the aggressive policies of Israel and the United States. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
In the limelight.
The U.S. military has claimed that it has permission to arrest people without charge and only on basis of being a suspect, to keep prisoners in detention indefinitely, particularly at the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The New York Times has covered this story and tells us more. A human rights panel of the United States has demanded the immediate release of Guantanamo prisoner Abu Zubaydah, who has been tortured by the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency. The United Nations Working Group on Arbitrary Detention urged the United States to release Abu Zubaydah, whose real name is Zainal Abidin Muhammad Hussein, from the prison at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, which is based within a U.S. Navy military base at Guantanamo Bay. The notorious prison was established by then-U.S. President George W. Bush in 2002 to hold foreign terrorism suspects following the suspicious 9/11 attacks in New York. Abu Zubaydah, now 52 years old, was captured in a raid in Pakistan just 2 months after the establishment of Guantanamo Bay detention camp, and has been held there without charge since 2006. He is the first detainee to be waterboarded by the CIA after the 9/11 events. The United Nations panel said that after studying other cases at Guantanamo over the past 15 years, it had seen a pattern that could constitute crimes against humanity. Washington claims that although Abu Zubaydah, born in Saudi Arabia, was never a member of the Al-Qaeda terrorist group, he has been held indefinitely in the so-called war against terrorism because he allegedly helped militants reach Afghanistan for training before the 9/11 attacks. The United Nations Working Group on Arbitrary Detention, which has no enforcement mechanism, also found that Abu Zubaydah had been denied a meaningful review of his detention and hence was being held against the law. The United Nations panel said in an opinion, the appropriate remedy would be to release Mr. Zubaydah immediately, and it caught him an enforceable right to compensation and other reparations in accordance with international law. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered the same story and tells us more. Abu Zubaydah was the first prisoner of a CIA black site, a global network of overseas secret prisons that held over 100 men beyond the reach of US law and the International Committee of the Red Cross from 2002 through to 2006. Two CIA contract psychologists devised a torture program of enhanced interrogation techniques specifically for use on him in an agency prison in Thailand, in which he was waterboarded, deprived of sleep, and confined in a coffin-like box. The panel said, in July of 2002, the Central Intelligence Agency acquired approval for the use of 10 enhanced interrogation techniques on Mr. Abu Zubaydah: attention grasp, walling, facial hold, insult slap, cramped confinement, exacerbating phobias, wall standing, stress positions, prolonged sleep deprivation, and the waterboard technique. It added that the torturers reportedly subjected Abu Zubaydah to ice baths, forced nudity, and sexual violence. Methods were tested on him that had never been discussed. The panel also lambasted five other countries where the US held Abu Zubaydah, that is, Afghanistan, Thailand, Poland, Morocco, and Lithuania. In 2018, the European Court of Human Rights condemned Lithuania and Romania for their complicity in the CIA torture program. The United Nations also censured the complicity of the United Kingdom, whose spy agencies had US interrogators question Abu Zubaydah at black sites despite its knowledge of his extreme mistreatment. Back in 2019, Abu Zubaydah drew some sketches of how he was tortured. His lawyers made the sketches public, triggering an outcry from human rights groups across the world. The infamous US military prison at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, which was supposed to be a temporary detention center and never meant to be a permanent prison, was chosen because of its ambiguous legal status. It is under full control of the US military and relatively close to the mainland United States, but beyond the reach of American courts, thus allowing detainees to be held indefinitely outside of normal laws or judicial oversight. The English website of Al Jazeera Television Network has also covered the same story. The International Committee of the Red Cross has unveiled foreign inmates who had been held captive for many years without trial in the US military prison and torture facility at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba are showing signs of accelerated aging. The International Committee of the Red Cross's head of delegation for the United States and Canada, Patrick Hamilton, said, "We're calling on the US administration and Congress to work together to find adequate and sustainable solutions to address these issues." Patrick Hamilton added, action should be taken as a matter of priority. Most of the violations at Guantanamo were attested by numerous U.S. military officers appointed to represent the inmates in courts of law, with very limited access to legal resources and classified documents to adequately defend the inmates or make a legal case against U.S. military and spy agencies involved in the illegal capture and imprisonment of most of the captives held at Guantanamo. Patrick Hamilton said he was struck by how those who are still detained today are experiencing the symptoms of accelerated aging, worsened by the cumulative effects of their experiences and years spent in detention. The senior International Committee of Red Cross official called for detainees to receive adequate mental and physical health care and more frequent family contact, basic rights that U.S. military has brutally refrained to provide for the Guantanamo prisoners. Without elaborating, a Pentagon spokesperson claimed the U.S. Defense Department is currently reviewing the report. Recently, the oldest inmate at Guantanamo, Saifullah Paracha, has been released to his home country of Pakistan after 19 years of detention at Guantanamo. Like most prisoners at Guantanamo, the Pakistani businessman was never formally charged and had little legal power to challenge his detention. The appalling treatment of the foreign captives at Guantanamo came to symbolize the excesses of the purported U.S. war on terror because of harsh interrogation and torture methods widely censured by critics. This is why the U.S. government, which regularly drafts and widely publicizes numerous reports judging and censuring other countries on their human rights observance, has allowed very limited access to the Guantanamo detention facility for international inspectors. Moreover, most Western human rights organizations, such as the British-based Amnesty International and the US-based Human Rights Watch, have kept mostly silent on the horrendous treatment of foreign captives at Guantanamo Bay, as well as foreign refugees, by border guards in the US and other Western countries. The United States and Britain have been key players in the brutal military invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq and are on record for committing enormous atrocities while occupying the war-torn countries for many years. There were still 40 inmates left in the Guantanamo prison when current US President Joe Biden took office in 2021. The Biden administration has claimed it wants to close the infamous facility but has never presented a plan for doing so. The previous Democratic administration of Barack Obama also made a similar pledge when Obama was sworn into office in 2008, but also failed to do so. Patrick Hamilton urged Washington to resolve.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzi Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has won the presidential runoff election and has now been at the helm for 2 decades, first as prime minister and since 2014 as president. This was a close election and the first time in Turkey's history that there was a runoff. His opposition, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, claims that Erdogan used state funds to get elected, but regardless of how he ran his campaign, he has been re-elected for another 5 years. We will talk about what lies ahead for Turkey as it is facing many challenges and which direction Erdogan will turn, to the east or west, for his foreign policy priority. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Mahmoud Refat, international relations expert out of Stockholm. Ali Safari, journalist and foreign affairs analyst out of Tehran.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with me. Well, let's start it off in Stockholm with Mahmoud. After being in power for 20 years, do you see Erdogan changing direction of the way he had governed before because of perhaps not having suitable results, or will he continue on the same path because at the end of the day, he did get reelected?
Well, Erdogan will continue what he started, because Erdogan is very clear today. He is looking for not to be president, but to be replacing to Atatürk, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, in the image of the builder of Turkey. And if the existential presence of the name of Turkey linked to Mustafa Kemal Atatürk and the social regime above all, which he put at that time, which is the secular regime, the way of Erdogan is to make something how to build a new social regime in Turkey. That became very clear. And let's admit he's enough magician in order to succeed to do all these social and radical changes in a society he received in 2002-2003, almost 20 years ago, which was very stable on specific rules were put and planted by Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. And he changed this construction, which is not easy at all. There were deep state built based on this regime. He could dissolve and dismantle this deep state. There were many institutions, and on top of these institutions, the military, the army, who is armed and carrying armed and cannot really be taken as easy, this institution. And who tried to make the coup d'etat against him in 2016. All these considerations he could dissolve at and build a new social regime in Turkey. Accordingly, I don't think he will change anything in his way of direction and his way next 5 years, despite I wonder if he continued the 5 years, but that I can talk about that later in another intervention. But for the moment, no. He is building his image as for the history now, with the image of Turkey and with the infrastructure he made for Turkey.
Okay. Well, Ali, what are the main challenges that you think Erdogan will face now?
Well, yeah, I think one of the most important challenges that Erdogan may face with the next presidential term that he will serve is that, as you have mentioned, this was the first time in history that in Turkish presidential election they have experienced a runoff. So it means somehow Erdogan has experienced the danger of falling his government. So he has to, first of all, take some necessary steps, first of all, to prevent falling his power. He may also face with this challenge to somehow find another person in his party. There is some expectation about his son-in-law, Bayraktar, that may take the position of Erdogan in the power in future. So this this is, first of all, one of his challenges to secure his position and also power for the next terms. And also one of the most important challenges that he's facing with is the economy. You know, Turkish economy is facing with different challenges, including the, losing the lira position as a currency. So also in the field of international relationship, Erdogan also is facing with different challenges with the Western governments and also in the region, including Syria, and the affairs between the Karabakh things between the Azerbaijan and Armenia. So I think these are the main challenges that Erdogan is facing with, and he has to also point and implement a strategy to face and cope with them.
Well, Mahmoud, trying to show that he's helping the economy, 5 days before the presidential election, Erdogan raised the salaries of workers by 45%. He also increased pensions and gave discounts on energy bills. Let's talk about the effects of those acts now. I mean, do you think that this will just add to more inflation, or how do you assess those acts?
Well, Erdogan is adopting economic plans that controversial, yes, but until now did not impact Turkey negatively in a serious way, simply because his real plan, I mean economic plan, not the appearing things which we are talking about in the media, is to have a strong infrastructure inside Turkey. And I think he succeeded so far to make a strong infrastructure, to attract lots of investments from abroad, to build a big military infrastructure, and to sell it outside the drones, which the Turkey now is almost the number two or three worldwide in selling this kind of drones, especially the chemicals drones, which the suicide drones, and lots of other military equipment. Now Turkey became big exporter for that. So far, I don't think also he will change the existing situation immediately. On the contrary, I think he will continue in that despite the inflation, because this inflation is not threatening the life of Turkish society in a dramatic way. On the contrary, somehow the ability to have money by people, I mean to have credits, to have loans, and to build stores, to build projects, especially small projects, that affecting positively the individuals. That's why the inflation in the society is not that negatively impacting the situation. For this reason, I think President Erdogan will continue his politics. He will not change the politics for the moment, despite the inflation.
Well, what do you think, Ali, because Mahmoud said he doesn't think the inflation is affecting the economy negatively, but we had last year officially inflation peaked at 85%. However, many analysts say the real inflation rate is 105%. I mean, your perspective about Turkey's economy?
Well, it's better to be rational. We are talking about numbers. This is a part of the reality. Turkish economy is suffering from the inflation that you have mentioned correctly, there must be some way to, face with that. We cannot ignore the bad situation of the Turkish economy. This is, as I said, part of the reality. You know, Turkish is suffering from lack of natural resources, and also they have experienced the challenges because of the sanctions that Turkey has experienced in the, past 2 or 3 years. So these all things they are affecting the Turkish economy. And when the Turkish economy is, doing so bad like that, like it or not, it's going to, affect the daily life of Turkish people. One of the most, bold thing that the Kılıçdaroğlu was using to target Erdogan was economy. He was asking the people, do you know what is the main reason that you are, war situation, worse economic situation? The main reason of that is because of Erdogan. So we cannot deny that. And also, as I said, we cannot just blame Erdogan for that. I said that Turkey is suffering of some imposed sanction against Turkey. So I think we cannot deny and ignore that. We Erdogan has to find some way in order to secure his power. He has to cope with that and also, as I said, find a solution for the ongoing economic situation of Turkey.
Okay, well, Mahmoud, earlier today, on Monday, the Turkish lira plummeted to a record low after the announcement of Erdogan's re-election. The lira has lost 80% of its value since 2018. Your assessment of all of this, why do you think this happened today with the lira just plummeting like that? And in general, why has the lira lost so much of its value in the last few years?
Well, the fact the lira to lose its value, that's true. It happened. It lost 80% of its value in the last 5 years or 6 years. That because of internal reasons and external reasons. Don't forget the strikes existed against Erdogan, in particular from some Gulf countries just after the coup d'etat in 2016. It started big war on the lira, and we remember how some Gulf countries fired the markets of Turkey at that time. That happened. But Erdogan, again, in my opinion, this gentleman is a real magician because he can play and manipulate everything and all things. He used this inflation and this liquidity of money, which is not healthy, principally in the economic sciences, in the books of economy, we learn this is not healthy for the economy of any state, of any country, and the government with the to put the central bank with principal measure number one is to fight this inflation and to put politics to control the market. But Erdogan, really magician, he used this inflation and this kind of liquidity, existing liquidity of cash in the society to push banks to give lots of loans to individuals. Like that, individuals became themselves somehow rich and independent, not waiting the government to give them every single thing. They took this money, these individuals, and that which we witness, who visit Turkey, will witness that so much in different regions, not only in Istanbul, but in all regions of Turkey. You will witness that people, normal people, having their own projects, having a store, having a small factory of clothing, for example, having a small food fabrication, things like that, that Erdogan pushed this inflation to be used in that. And meantime, I repeat, Erdogan was feeling safe for the general and the global situation of the Turkish economy because of the infrastructure which he put for this economy. This is not a country, doesn't have any other opportunity to live or under embargo of dictator regime who is making the military to violate all the economic sectors like some Arabic countries, for example. No, it's open society where lots of investors come, where this society selling lots of military equipments and non-military equipments, so there is still the economic life and very good life compared to the non-inflation while the markets to be closed.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, well, let's switch over to foreign policy side of things. Ali, do you think that Erdogan will implement changes, a different strategy when we're looking at foreign policy? And if so, what do you think he may change?
Oh, yeah, thank you for that question. You know, in the past 20 years that Erdogan was in power, he wasn't emulating the ways of his predecessor. I mean, the people who was in power before Erdogan. He was trying to just work for the interest of himself and Turkey. Whenever the interest was calling for any decisions, he would do that. You know, when, for example, the interest of Turkey or himself calls for a normalization of relationship with Israel, he would definitely do that. Or, for example, whenever it's the time for attacking Israel, also would do that. So I think based on the experience that we have had from Erdogan in the past 20 years, I think if the some elements of some, I mean, external ones doesn't change, he wouldn't have any kind of changing his policies regarding the, I mean, the regional policies of show what. But one thing is to note that I think some other players may take different decisions with the, for the next presidential term of Erdogan. I think Russia is one of them. Russia, I'm based on my, I mean, the analysis that I have, Russia will not let Turkey to interfere in Karabakh and the clashes between Azerbaijan and Armenia again, because they will not let the balances of power change in favor of Turkey and Azerbaijan more than the current situation. About the Syria, Syria is one of also the most important, I mean, files of international policy of Erdogan. You know, he, one of the members of his campaign promised that Erdogan will meet the Syrian president until the January. And we know that this is one of the conditions that Bashar al-Assad, the Syrian president, has made for Erdogan. He will not meet with him until he withdraw all of Turkish troops from the Syrian soil. So right. I think, as I can see, he will not change his policies until some other players, including Iran and Russia, change their strategy towards Erdogan, or maybe put some pressure on him. And as I said, based on our experience, whenever the conditions and the interests of himself demands, he will change his direction.
Well, what do you think about that, Mahmoud? Erdogan, if we look at various approaches, it seems almost kind of schizophrenic in the nature. On the one hand, he shows, as Ali was talking about, for example, on the one hand, he shows that he is anti Israel, but on the other hand has relations with Israel. And there's so many other things. When it comes to Syria, I'm going to go back to that. We know that Russia is working on a rapprochement between Turkey and Syria. But as Ali had rightly pointed out about Syrian President Bashar Assad and what he says he wants the Turkish troops to leave Syria before meeting with Erdogan. Do you think that's going to happen? Do you think that the Turks are ready to stop its occupation of Syrian territory?
Well, principally, let's start from a political rule, which we teach, or some professors teach to their students of political science or international relations. In international relations, there is no fixed values. There is pragmatism. Somehow Erdogan is following very, very well this rule, which says there is no fixed value or fixed lines in the international relations. In the international relations, there is interest. The language and the major is the interest of the state, number one, and number two, for the regime who is governing this state. Erdogan is much, much more pragmatic than we can think. He played very well with the Israeli card, and this was one of strongest cards he employed at the time of the ship Marmara, in order to wake up the Islam spirit inside the Turkish society at that time. And he succeeded very, very, very well. And at that time, he was adopting a confrontation politics. Today, he adopted, like 2 years and a half ago, adopted zero problems and was his first destination to go to and to send his Minister of Foreign Affairs was Israel, in order to open to him the heart of Washington, D.C. He is very, very well knowledgeable of the international relation ground, how this ground is working, how it's functioning. It's not functioning by ethics, the international ground, and never functioned by through ethics or good manners. It has been always working through interests. Secondly, he opened the way at the gate through Qatar with the Egyptian regime, and he started to exchange some economic interests and some conversation, etc. Until he reached the Syrian ground. The Syria, for him, for Erdogan, represent 2 points. Number one, the Kurds, who are making, we can say it, headache since a long time for several countries in the region. Especially when it comes to the independence of Kurdistan or to the separation of, and this is very normal, by the way, for any nation to be very worried about its integrity and about its land. This is very normal. So this is number one. He wants to attain a big victory in this.
Thirty seconds, Mahmoud. 30 seconds. Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay, this is number one. And number two, he wants to take prize and very good prize from the international community for returning back the Syrian refugees. By the way, to end this point, Erdogan closed the borders in front of Syrian refugees since 2015, by the way. So there is no ethics in international relations. This is the theory Erdogan adopting.
Okay, at 30 seconds, Ali, final comments.
Well, I think I somehow answer to your questions. I think, first of all, Turkey is not able to continue the occupation forever. They have to leave the territory of other country someday. But this is right that your guest has mentioned. They want to also negotiate on that, to take some points from other countries.